Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own unique stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. In this episode, I was joined by Tom Nash, aka Mr. Divorce Coach, to talk about healing from infidelity and after affairs. Tom is the UK's premier internationally certified male divorce coach and knows firsthand the roller coaster of emotions and practical challenges of separation, having grown up with divorced parents in a blended family and having been through his own divorce. He retrained after his divorce as a master NLP practitioner in coaching and now supports individuals and couples with the emotional, mindset, and practical realities of their divorce, separation, or their co-parenting. He's regularly in the media sharing his unique expertise from BBC Radio to The Times and ITV's This Morning. Topics we cover in this episode include the reasons why people cheat, how a victim of an affair isn't always a victim of the marriage, the situations when reconciliation is possible, how to work through an affair, and the role of shared accountability. He explains how coaching offers an opportunity for self-reflection and growth. And we end the episode with Tom sharing his top tips for navigating a blended family based on his personal and professional experience. If you loved this episode, then please subscribe and rate us on your preferred listening platform. Welcome, Tom.
Hello.
It's lovely to have you and thank you so much for joining us. This episode's all about infidelities, but before we jump into the meat of that, I think it's really interesting just to explore what brought you to this point. So how did you become Mr. Divorce Coach?
Well, in a snapshot, in a previous life, I'd spent around 15 years in the City of London running recruitment businesses. Myself and my ex-wife separated in early 2017. I was just starting to retrain in coaching and the various parts that we were talking about a minute ago. And in terms of the finances and the actual divorce process, it was relatively straightforward as it could be. I haven't seen a necessarily amicable, but relatively simple. But then it came to the child arrangement orders and the ensuing bitterness and contentiousness kind of came up there, really. I had finished off my coaching and various other training in 2019. And then just as I was originally going to actually go and do workplace wellbeing coaching, which was for the recruitment industry, it was actually my new partner that turned around one day and said, you could use these skills to help other people going through a divorce or separation, particularly other guys who maybe don't want to or have a stigma around going to a therapist or a counsellor, for example, and maybe they're actually looking at a different vocation, different form of support. So we had a Google one night and lo and behold, found out that divorce coaching was a thing. But after a few pages of Google, what we couldn't find was any men doing it. So beginning of October 2019, we founded Mr. Divorce Coach.
What's interesting is it's a really female-dominated area, family law generally, and you're right, yeah. The sort of breakout services from that all seem to be very female-focused. So it is really interesting to talk to somebody that has that kind of male expertise and that perspective. So you looked around, there was nobody else doing it. How did you start then? Where did you start? What did you do?
A lot of networking with lawyers, mediators, barristers, and it was actually bringing in and looking at all of my own personal life experiences, the bits that I'd taken and thought worked well, bits that I didn't think that had worked well. How could I apply them to support other people? Not in terms of advice giving, because that's not what coaches do, but helping to people understand what all the different situations and scenarios and eventualities could be. The types of experiences that they're going to process both in internal dialogue with themselves as well as external in behaviours and where those emotions get driven. And to really help people to be able to find a more positive way, we, as I mentioned, myself, my ex-wife, it was quite contentious when it comes to child arrangement orders. Anyone that's been and read the Times Ask Call or looked at me online at all, we make no bones about it. I had an affair. I had met and fallen in love with someone new. My relationship had been breaking down prior to that. Not that either one of us had really talked about it or approached it in the right way, should we say. So it's taking all those experiences and then how we applied that to find a better way to work together. I'd filled out the C100s, I'd had the CAFCAS calls, we'd had our day in court, as it were. We got the ink dry on a court order, but then actually, how did we live within the real world of it? Practically day to day, how do we operate as co-parents with new spouses, step-parenting, all this sort of stuff? And of course, in a really weird twist of fate, my ex-wife's new boyfriend, I say they've been together 5 years, is my partner's ex-husband. So in our situation, the parents effectively swapped around. So
yeah, so the players remain the same. There's four of you all in it together, and it was a swap round of partners. It's intriguing. Yeah. Do you think that brought its own special dynamic to it then?
Oh, absolutely. Because there isn't one, let's say, independent party on the periphery that can say, well, hold on, have you thought about this? Or can we look at this slightly differently? Everyone has an emotional investment
in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. And myself and my ex-wife have two children. My partner and her ex-husband have two children. So we've also got this little melting pot of four kids that fluidly move between the two homes. Mm-hmm. And in each home, we've got the alternate set of bio and non-bio parents. So ultimately, we had to find a way together. It was essentially forced that we needed to find a different approach. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of hard work, a lot of biting your tongue, a lot of having to catch yourself, not create some of your own obstacles, really look at how you're showing up, but also what part you're bringing to the table in this experience. A lot of reflection, consistencies, apologies, a whole host of different things that we had to go through together. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's all about how we put the children at the centre and not the middle.
Let's come on to the children. Because this episode is all about affairs and infidelity. So let's start there then and just talk to me a little bit, not just from your own personal experience, but as a coach. Why do people cheat when they're married or in a long-term relationship? Is that an important facet to understand, or is that irrelevant?
There could be a whole multitude of different reasons that people can give. And they're all valid, but of course, unhappiness, unfulfillment, poor communications, disconnected. Essentially, when you get down to the crux of what's underneath it all, is actually craving a form of desire and compassion and connection. And however they feel that they're missing that, either through poor communications, through sexual gratification, whatever it might be that's missing, it's also that people are looking to chase that happiness. And we live obviously in a insta world now, don't we, as well? And societal views and have shifted on how we view relationships. I mean, infidelity and affairs have been around for as long as marriage has, so it's not like it's a new concept in any way, shape or form. It's around our human behaviors and probably what we're missing as well in relationships. And again, that could not necessarily be down to either a physical or even emotional connection. It might actually just be about that ability to communicate our new wants and desires and passions in life and things like that, that actually we haven't evolved together. And actually what you then find is fears within the relationship, not the poor communication, but the disconnect is driven by a fear of actually showing this part of you that wasn't there when you were first together 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's a new part of you, but our interests change and the things that we want and belief change. Our values stay the same, but our beliefs can ultimately change. And again, it's what's going on for the individuals in that scenario. But again, there's always a whole host of different things that's going on for any given person. I've always said, and I've said this on a couple of other things, that nobody who's in a happy relationship, have people who are in content relationships that have affairs. Obviously, people that are very unhappy. We don't have happy people. Very rarely happy people are having affairs. And I'm talking about people that are falling in love. I'm not talking about people that are trying to complete Tinder in their spare time whilst they're married. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about people that have fallen in love with someone, they've had that disconnect, they've found it elsewhere. But ultimately, no one wakes up on a Tuesday morning and goes, that one, I'm leaving for them. There's a systematic build-up to how that person's got there and actually how they've both got there in that relationship as well.
And what if you are confronted with the fact that your partner has had an affair, is there a right way to handle that? And are there some questions that you should be asking in order to be able to process kind of what's happened yourself? Or is it a lot more sort of individual than there being a sort of a pathway out of it, if you like, or a pathway to some kind of acceptance or moving on or however the relationship then, you know, the next stage it moves to.
The next stages, yeah. A lot of people are go-to is because we have our thoughts. There's a trigger an event and we have a thought, right? And thoughts come and go, just like the weather, right? And they come and go, and we process those thoughts, and then they evoke a feeling, right? So that thought plus feeling, and then it creates an actionable behavior, emotionally charged, emotionally driven, whether it be happy or sad or whatever it might be. What is typically happening in that earlier phase is obviously where that trust and betrayal, et cetera, has all come in, or even the guilt that's there for the person that's had the affair. The type of questions get driven by the emotional thoughts and the emotional processes, the actionable behaviors. And it's thing, if you think about like the Friends episode with Rachel, where she says to Ross, so was she better than me? And it's, we start to ask questions that actually evoke visualization and kind of self-traumatize. And actually what we don't necessarily need is the detail, because that's not helping us. That's not helping us understand. It's not helping us to move past the event. And it doesn't actually help ourselves to then build our own comparisons. Okay. So actually starting to look at that other questions in terms of events that have led to, but then also maybe understanding, right, so how did you feel, asking the person that's had the affair, how did you feel when you then came home? How did you feel after? What were you thinking about? I speak to a lot of people on both sides of this equation, men and women. And 99.9% of the time, the person who has had the affair is carrying a huge amount of guilt, huge amount of self-resentment. We don't talk about believer's guilt enough, because we are taught through societal views, everything we've grown up with, and TV and so on and so forth. Somebody that has an affair, falls in love with someone else and has commits adultery is inherently evil. They are automatically...
bad person, yeah.
And in some respects, equally for the victim of the affair isn't necessarily always the victim of the marriage, which is a kind of weird concept to try and grasp. But when you think about it, is when you think about the other events that have led to, and why we're saying about why people have affairs. So looking at the events that lead to, and what was the thought process, and what was missing, or and all that sort of thing. But again, that's the great thing about coaching. It's not about the external force. It's looking at the self-reflective piece, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so how did we get to this stage? Less of the why. We've got that why. It's in our face. We already know about it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what do I want to do with that information? How do I want to process it? What do I need to know versus what am I potentially saying I want to know that could actually just traumatize me further? Do I really need to know those nitty-gritty details? Is that something that's actually going to serve me right now as well as in 6 months or 6 years' time to have had a evokeness for myself? So it's looking at it differently in terms of where is the understanding to the problem.
I think the other thing that always strikes me, because we experience in what we do, that what we call the guilt window all of the time. So sometimes people can come along, decide they want to get divorced. They can decide they're going to do it amicably. And essentially they're doing it amicably because one of them, the person usually that's had the affair, is feeling so guilty, they'll agree to almost anything. And we know that that doesn't lead to a long-term sustainable, you know, outcome, and not something often that a court's likely to agree is a fair result kind of thing. So we have to be really sort of aware and cognizant of that guilt window and when it's playing into people's desire to be amicable. But if at that stage, you know, you've got somebody who there's been an affair, the relationship has broken down, does it always lead to the end of the relationship? Is it possible to recover after an affair? I feel like a tabloid headline. But in your experience, when you coach people, can you coach them back together effectively?
You can. It can be done. It's plausible reconciliation. What you then have to look at and consider, especially in coaching or any other kind of support vocation, if you're working with the individual or indeed both of them, is someone leaning in and is someone leaning out? So where's the motivation? Is there motivation? Do they want this to define the relationship and the legacy that it leaves or indeed carries on? And the other part is, if people are going to be staying together after an act of adultery and infidelity, is it to survive or is it to grow? Now, again,
really good distinction. That sort of hits it on the head for me.
But you absolutely can repair it. It's going to come down to about the motivation. Do people want to? Then it's about how do they do it? Because what they need to do is restore a new version of trust. They need to learn how to communicate better and honestly. In actual fact, an act of an affair could potentially open the window for some of the most brutally honest conversations that a couple have had in years. And then we can start to really get down to the crux of things. And is there plausibility here to carry on in a different way?
And when you're working as a coach with somebody where they've either had an affair or been on the receiving end of the affair, what sort of work are you doing with them? Because let's say that they've decided the marriage is over. They're with you as Mr. Divorce Coach because they're going through the divorce. Mm-hmm. What sort of things help them to be able to navigate that divorce process in a way that's going to get a good outcome for them and the family, rather than it spiraling down into, you know, that hurt, emotional, angry kind of interaction, fighting every single point because of the hurt and the anger that's coming from a sort of an emotional issue, not from the sort of fairness of the settlement or anything else. So what do you typically do to help people navigate that process?
So I talk quite a lot with people around how they're learning to regulate their emotions. So rather than overcoming them, it's that in time, that has an element of time and change and going through the process, but it's about how they learn to regulate them first. And to regulate them, they need to figure out what they really are for them. So if someone's angry about, let's say, being the aggrieved party, the person's been cheated on, if they're angry, okay, so what's underneath that surface level, that first level of emotion and that feeling, what's underneath it? And there's going to be betrayal. That's what's triggering the anger. So what's underneath the betrayal? Typically humiliation. Okay. So what's coming underneath humiliation? Fear of judgment, internal or external. So when we're helping people to process and understand what those emotions are, they can learn to regulate them differently. You've also then got things, again, just working with a grief party here for a moment, you've got, and my ex-wife commented about this in the Times article, because obviously it's a piece where all three of us, my girlfriend, myself, and my ex-wife, are all talking about the same, our own experiences of the same event, right? Mm. And one of the huge things was around that, not just confidence, but self-worth and self-value. Before we can even build on that confidence, we really need to look at how we value ourselves, what's our self-worth, right? Our self-esteem, and build from there. If it's someone with the guilt and resentment, it's typically looking at where's that come from. So again, we're kind of working it back. And those clients are typically, they have, it's really conflicting for us, causing internal conflict with essentially their values. I was one of those people that had always said, I would, once I'm married and I've got kids, that's it. Off market forever, never even gonna blink at anybody else, right? So when you become the thing that you have always vowed just even to yourself that you're never gonna be, right, that brings huge internal turmoil. So it's helping people in that instance for dealing with leaver's guilt to start to practice self-forgiveness strategies, how they're understanding, why they're helping them to understand how they got to where they are and those triggers that led to, so that we can alleviate some of that guilt for them. They can take that pressure off that they're not the world's worst person, and that for the decisions that they have made and the actions they have taken, that is where they're at that time. So helping people to process the emotions, learn to regulate them, rebuild self-esteem, and then really about how they then want to move forward, because that's the other part. It's that those bits seem quite obvious, but when people then get to a certain point, it's, well, you probably hear it as well all the time, can't see the wood for the trees, or whatever it might be, those kind of anecdotal statements. It's helping people to unpack all the different paths, all the different eventualities, taking that path, where might that lead, and unpacking it all and making things very real for people so they can understand at least what their options and their choices are, so they're not stuck in the narrative of, or the emotional narrative, I should say, of where they're currently sitting.
It sounds like some of the common themes that you mentioned there from where we overlap as well would be around the fear of, when you're talking about where do you go from here, what's the moving on strategy? We get a lot of people who feel quite stuck because it's frightening. It's frightening because letting go of the relationship is letting go of the lifestyle. It's letting go of everything around you, your home, all what you think of as normal. You're letting go big chunks of that in order to move forward. And I always think a really important part is helping people create a vision of the future. So they've got something to aim at, because their future that they were going to have no longer exists. And therefore there's grief and the processing of grief to do. But you've got to replace that with something. So you've got to have something to aim for. I wonder how, you know, does that come into it from your perspective when you're coaching people as well?
Yeah, because a lot of that is recalibrating expectations. People that maybe built their expectations on, against their good party, of how they were going to, what their life was expecting, but what they thought their future held for them as well. And again, that's starting to look into things like their value system, their beliefs hierarchy, the things that they want to in their core achieve in their life, the things that bring them joy and happiness, and how they want to be as an individual, to help them recalibrate that. And again, that things like the lifestyle, that can be a huge thing for a lot of people as well. That societal shift of not being in that particular clique anymore, because now they're maybe living on a different side of town and things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of work in terms of helping people to recalibrate their perspective and reframing and looking at things through a different lens, but about creating opportunity and reinstilling hope for people as well is a huge thing.
Yes, absolutely. And we talked a little bit at the beginning about children. I just wonder if, in fact, they do, how do children fit into the narrative of an affair? Is there any place for the child or the children in that narrative? Or how do you keep that narrative away? I mean, if you've got older kids, they might know, for example. So what are the do's and don'ts around children and affairs?
Yeah, this has to come down to the uniqueness of the parents as well. As much as the ages, maturities, et cetera, of the children, the parent-child relationships, if that parent relationship status is already strained beforehand, before any of this. And again, you've got to look at for what purpose. The question I'm always asking clients, for what purpose? What are you trying to achieve from this? Is this about emotional justice, vengeance, whatever it might be? However, there are certain, in context, there are certain times where actually it's potentially pertinent. So some of our children, my collective four kids, two of them know the details and two of them don't, because two of them are much younger. And the older two had their own questions as they got older. One of them was preteen at the time anyway. So there are certain parts that she knew before her brothers did. And now as they're starting to come through, it's about sharing that with them, particularly more so for me because of what I do and the way that I share life experiences and stories. But as adjacent to that, for me, it was also a part of actually showing what lessons that I want to instill in my kids. Right? I want to show them that actually their parents are not infallible. We are vulnerable. We make mistakes. How do we deal with them though? How do we approach them? And what do we do when we make a mistake? Right? And a lot of times when I'm working with clients as well, and particularly around things like talking with children, and I'll say this and think about any basic parenting life lesson you want to instill in your children and the types of things that you want, the types of people you want them to be and behaviors you want them to have. How are you showing up and doing the same thing in your actions and behaviors? Whilst you're trying to, you would love your children to be empathetic. You want them to be emotionally intelligent. You want them to be caring and forgiving. So by doing what you're doing, how is it actually showing them what that life lesson is? Right? You want them to be able to own their truth as well. So for me, it was really important that I did share. But again, much like when we were talking earlier about the questions for the agreed party, they don't need the nitty-gritty details. They don't need any specifics. The words and the terminology and the phrases that we use creates our environment. And it's about how we then instill that, creating it in somebody else's environment. So it's really important about what are we sharing. The other thing is do the parents do this together? Or does one parent do it? But you've both got to be on the same page.
I think we always say it's usually best to do it together. I imagine if there's been an affair, it's almost, I don't know, doubly important in a way to present a united front, because what's gone on between the parents isn't about what goes on as a parenting team with the kids, is it? The kids will still need to be parented by the two of you. And, you know, in some cases, as you say, if you have blended family in tow, then there's other parents to involve potentially as well. But it strikes me that it's important that you've got to be, whatever's happened between the two of you, you've got to be a supportive parenting team, because that's, I think, what causes distress for children. If it's like, well, I'm going to tell the children because you've had the affair, that doesn't intuitively feel right to me. It feels like you've got a parent then who's disempowered and who's being infantilized almost.
I did have a client, well, I had a couple of clients that have said, I'm going to tell the children he or she's done ABC. And then it's about, what's the purpose of it? Is it about regaining back that control, like you say, and control the narrative, or to depict the other person as the baddie? And then it's also then looking at, how is that actually about what your child's wants and needs are in terms of that parenting relationship with both of you, not just one of you, and how much of it is it about your stuff? Yeah. And actually, where could you go and process that better? Where's another outlet for you to go and utilize that and vent that and understand it? I run my practice on three core values, which is very simply understand, evolve, and improve. Everybody wants the improved part. Everyone wants the final piece. Yeah, the better way to be. I just want to be over there. I want to be 2 years down the line or 6 months down the line. But to do that, we need to evolve, which means we need to change. We need to do something different. But to evolve and make positive change, we need to do the understanding and self-reflection. What part have I played in this role? Right? What can I do differently? Like the old saying of, if it isn't broke, don't fix it. Well, if it is, we need to fix it. So how do we fix it? What do we need to do? Where's my accountability piece in this?
And it feels like even after the affair, you have to be the stronger parenting team almost, don't you? Because you need both parents, whether they're the person who's had the affair or the person who hasn't, you need both of them on the same page to help hold that emotional space for the kids. That must be incredibly hard when you're carrying such raw emotions. I think there's a big difference between an event that has catalyzed a divorce and the other type of divorce where people over a period of time have come to the conclusion that, you know, they no longer both either want to be together. When there's been an event and a thing that's happened or a point in time where it's all come together, it feels like you've got to work twice as hard as the parenting team to hold that space for your kids. And that is hard to do when you are that raw. Irrespective of which role you've taken, you are raw at that point.
No, I mean, it's one thing that I was always adamant about was there was certain parenting rules or approaches that myself and my ex always had that I was always making sure that we kept that united front and things like that. Not necessarily where we agreed, but we would still back each other up. Even down to the simplest of things, like, I don't know, I'm there to pick the boys up and she's told them to put their shoes on three times and it's still not happening. It's still on Xbox. They're not doing anything. And if we were still together, I would have gone in there and been like, boys, mum told you three times. Stop to respect her. Go and apologise. Switch your headphones on. Get shoes on. Right, I've got to back her up. And that's still my role as a parent and a co-parent. We chose to make these children together. We have to continue to do that in a different way. And it just looks and feels a bit different.
How do you deal with things like if a child becomes resentful when there's been an affair? So if the child, for whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, knows what's happened and the child effectively takes on those adult emotions, they're not necessarily the child's emotions, are they, sometimes, but they take on and defend effectively a parent. How do you deal with that kind of stuff? What can you help parents with to overcome that?
That is really, really difficult because you've also, again, working it back, you've got to look at where has it come from? What has created that outcome? Where was the catalyst to that? And typically it would be a parent has said something somewhere along the lines, or again, their own relationships or their view of what relationships are. Mm-hmm. So again, have they been raised in what they thought was a happy home, but actually it was a very, very low conflict, but also low communication, low intimacy household. Mm-hmm. Like, again, it's kind of checks and balances, isn't there? A child that grows up in a loving, caring, intimate, emotionally connected environment is going to have a very different outcome. A lot of the time that is, because obviously I don't work with children, I only work with adults. So if I'm working with one parent, let's say it's the person that had the affair and that's coming up for them, what we need to do is work back at, well, where's the source come from? So actually, is it about their communication, connection, co-parenting relationship with their ex, actually? Because if that's the person that the child has been listening to or has taken it from or whatever, we need to find that new way to get back to the former united front. And that's about rebuilding new forms of trust and new bonds and new ways of working together. But it can be really, really difficult, particularly if you've got adult children as well. Because if you've got adult children who are, I don't know, in their 20s or 30s, for example, and if it's also let's say they've had a partner, a long-term relationship with someone who's cheated on them and they've never actually understood it, because it's never been in the family line anywhere, or the previous family dynamics, not even just direct, but external family as well. If it's something that's completely alien to them, that they don't understand it, they are going to already form their own opinions about what someone's like when they do that. And the automatic bad person comes in again. Yeah.
So they superimpose that, don't they, on the parental situation.
Absolutely. That's, again, another fundamental reason why for me it's really important that I did talk to our children. Mm. And I did have those honest conversations when it was pertinent, when they were mature enough, at a phase in their lives when actually they could understand it, but they don't need the detail, but they can also have a more wider view of what adult relationships look like and how to better behave and act should they be in an unhappy relationship so that they don't end up having an affair.
You make a really important point there as well, Tom, that this isn't a one-off conversation, is it? Talking to the children about what's happened. It's an ongoing series of conversations as they hit different maturities and milestones and as different questions come up for them. Mm-hmm. I always say that to parents. You know, we have a lot of conversations about what do I say to my kids? And we often do like sessions where we almost script that first conversation, but always trying to give the parents the skills to be able to navigate the conversation because they come up again and again and again. And you do find, you think you've had it, you think you've explained something. And then in another couple of years' time, their brains completely rewired themselves. it's like you've never had the conversation. They have to go back to the beginning and go through it in a different way. And whether that's just the general divorce and separation part or whatever it is that, you know, is concerning them about the way that you're parenting. But it feels like it's an ongoing dialogue that you have to create with them.
Yeah, but and the other thing actually, tell you what has come out from not doing the recent time cycle thing was actually the fact that we as the parents, and not just about the kids, but about our old relationships, we still talk about them now. So it's not even like that was a conversation we had once years ago and it happened and we put that to bed. That's been a continued dialogue. There have been things that I found out a couple of weeks and months after we separated, right up until only a few weeks ago, when a particular thing came up or a topic or we read something or whatever it might be. And then me and my ex-wife talk about something and I'm still always learning, as is she. So again, it's not, and that's one of the things that I think has really helped us to form the really happy extended family of eight, because we actually refer to ourselves an extended blended family of eight. We just live in two different houses and the kids go, like I said, between. But I don't like the term step, but everybody else uses it, but my bonus children, their dad in front of them, obviously I don't call him daddy when it's just me and him going for a beer, but in front of the kids, I would say daddy Dan, or to my bonus kids, Leonie and Zach, I would always refer to him as dad or daddy and be like, oh, you're ahead. If they ask me a simple question, oh, who are we at this weekend? You're daddies. Oh, cool. Okay. But why would I not treat one of the most important people in their world with the utmost of respect that he deserves? And it's keeping that dialogue between all of us and that appreciation for one another, so that we all play different parts in these poor kids' lives. It's not down to just one of us. It's all of us. And that's where the continued dialogue is. It doesn't just stop with the kids. It's with the adults as well.
Yeah. And the language, as you say, is really important and really key, isn't it, to setting the expectations and the behaviour that follows. I'm really conscious of time, so we're going to have to do this a bit quickly then, but you must be the absolute master of the blended family then. So some top tips now that you have navigated the mother of all extended families. What are your key ones? What do you say to people when they're sort of heading into this territory?
Oh, God, key ones. Right. One of the very first things I always say about blended families and co-parenting, et cetera, is always future focus. So I always say about, let's just park co-parenting and families from it. How do you want to co-grandparent? What do you want this to look like, sound like, and feel like in 10, 12, 15 years when your three kids have all got three kids and they've got 9 first birthdays, 9 graduations, so on and so forth? How do you want to continue to live in this environment? So it's about like remaking it. Because a lot of people, they get, like I said, we're catastrophizing, we're focused on the moment and our miniature battles as we go along. And at some point, we'll kind of breathe a sigh of relief and go, oh, well, actually, this is a continual thing that keeps going. So helping people to future focus and understand how long this is going to last the rest of their lives, right? The other things that I'm always talking to people about is just from accountability piece. What part, how often do you stop and actually hold the mirror up to yourself? That thing that the other person's doing, their behaviours, their actions, what they're saying, how they're showing up, etc. How much of that is in part coming from the way that I'm showing up as well? How could I change something that could actually instill a positive shift here? Some of the other things I also talk about is the consistency. The olive branches, again, it's regular. It doesn't just stop, even when you then start to maybe find more common ground. Even if you can get to, dare I say it, a new form of friendship, it's still continual. Right? That respect be kind or human decency. I remember, I've told the story millions of times, Dan was dropping the kids off once and he was just about to leave. We knew that he was having a bit of a hard time with something. And I said to my partner, go out and invite him in for dinner. We'd never been face-to-face with each other before, well, once, but it wasn't very nice. And I said, go and invite me for dinner and don't take no for an answer. And she went out and said to him, come for dinner. He said, no, it will be weird. She said, it'll only be weird if you make it weird. He came in, he had dinner, and yes, it was weird, but we had to get through that awkwardness.
Yeah. Right?
Something has to give. If you want it to change, you've got to do something. So what could you do that could be better, that could be different? How could you keep doing it regularly and even differently? For blended families, how do you create inclusivity? Right? How do you make it involved? Whilst also not just meshing all these kids together. Because of their ages and their own experiences, sometimes I've heard this many times where, let's say a younger one that's 7 or 8 years old, they actually really want to meet the new partner, or actually they want to have them come around quite a lot, or they're looking forward to having them. But the 14, 15-year-old does not. So how are we creating, how are we being inclusive, but how are we still being diverse and equitable and consider everybody's different experiences?
Yeah. I always think sometimes we talk about the children as well, when actually it's four, in your case is four. They're all different. Individuals, and we have to tailor our approaches to them individually. And, you know, and that's okay. They don't have to be a pack that has utterly consistent stuff given to them the whole time. We can treat them as people, individuals.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, look, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. I could sit here all day. It's been really lovely. Thank you so much. Where can people find out more about you, Tom, if they want to get in touch?
Online, social media wise, I'm primarily on LinkedIn and Instagram. If you just put Tom Nash, Mr. Divorce Coach, you'll find me pretty much anywhere. But you can also reach me at MrDivorceCoach.co.uk.
Fabulous. Thank you. And I'm on Twitter. I'm at Kate_Daly. And you can hear about new podcast episodes by following at Divorce_podcast. And if you like this podcast and want to subscribe to further updates, you can visit us at thedivorcepodcast.com. Thanks very much indeed, Tom, and thank you everyone for listening.